that is kind of a supernatural thriller, but on the other hand, also a coming-of-age story. And it's also very much about that first moment away from your parents and trying to not only find yourself, but accept who you are. Do you dare be who you really are?
Following 2015's Louder Than Bombs, starring Isabel Huppert, director Joachim Trier returns to his Norwegian home with the supernatural thriller Thelma. From Midori House in London, this is The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. Also ahead...
Trick or tweet!
It's our Halloween special. We'll look at why horror and camp comedy often make good company, and we'll get a crash course in the fine art of making scary costumes. That's all to come on this terrifying edition of The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. There's something within Thelma, the teenage protagonist of Joachim Trier's new supernatural thriller. The Norwegian director is back in his hometown of Oslo following the 2015 drama Louder Than Bombs, which starred Isabel Huppert and was his first English language film. There are echoes of the classic high school horror Carrie in Trier's latest effort, with its story of a young woman on the verge of adulthood suffocating under the pressures of a devoutly religious family. As with another recent film set in Oslo, The Snowman, this is an urban setting best enjoyed cold. But while there are scares here, Trier is less concerned with genre frights and more interested in the psychology behind it all. Thelma could be described as a coming-of-age story or a supernatural take on the struggles that come with one's sexual awakening. Joachim Trier, we've got a protagonist here who's dealing with her burgeoning sexuality. She comes from a very difficult, suffocating family background, and there's also this thing with the whole scary powers as well. Are these all separate challenges, or do you see it as one central coming-of-age tale?
I hope that they're one thing. As a story, you know, in the past I've done more naturalist drama, I guess, is the genre definition. Genre is always tricky because you create something, you tell a story, and you use the means that you need. So I don't look at it from the outside. But what we knew we wanted to do this time, which was different, was to make something that was slightly larger than life, more spectacular, and venture into the supernatural. You know, I think we can still learn from fables and you know, fairy tales. We could learn something about being human, but we can exaggerate a bit, and we could use a larger canvas. So in this case, you know, it's the first film I've shot in CinemaScope, which means that it's a bigger picture, you know, and we did a lot of effect work, and it just feels like we owe the audience right now to go to the cinema and get something more than they can get on TV. So we try to do something that is intimate, yet, you know, it's visual.
And it looks absolutely marvellous. The use of CinemaScope has been done brilliantly. This could go either way, though, couldn't it, for you as a filmmaker? Because your previous film, Louder Than Bombs, was, I would describe it as a low-key drama. It was based around characters. And this is also based around characters, of course, but there are the elements thrown in there that could be described as genre filmmaking, adventures into horror cinema, psychological thriller territory. For you as a filmmaker, do you need an element of bravery to do that? Because I find that critics will go along to what could be described as a sensible film, and they'll sit there and the reaction is, this is a very sensible film. We can judge this in a sensible way. And then as soon as you throw in a few supernatural elements, it's like, oh, it's gone a bit silly now.
Yeah, that could happen. I mean, so far so good in America and Norway, at least so far, we've had a very good reception for it. But you know, I've been nervous, and I'm always worried when I make a film, you know, that I've gone too far or that it's strange. But I think that's what's fun about this as well. We owe the audience to take some risks and play around a bit. So many movies these days are so homogenous, and we know exactly what we're going to get. So I thought it would be kind of creatively challenging to try to combine these things. And, you know, I think there's something about a lot of films coming at the moment that are about superpowers and superheroes, but they're not really about things that are relatable for normal people. We're just looking at something that's a completely different world. And I thought the combination of something very close and trying to do this tender love story about a young woman falling in love with a girl and that being kind of complicated because of this kind of very religious conservative background she's from, and then throwing the supernatural powers in there and making her more mentally unstable, you know, because she's going through what almost turns into a nightmare. I thought that was a possibility to create different images, more subliminal images, more mysterious kind of scenes. And yeah, so yeah, I'm out on a limb here. Let's see what happens. You know, I've fingers crossed for the critics.
I couldn't agree with you more that a lot of superhero films tend to be about fantastic abilities and not so much about the human side. The superhero genre, I think, is done best when it is actually about humans and how humans interact with those fantastic abilities rather than the person who has those abilities. For you, where does the humanistic side come from, the fantastical elements that are in your film? How does that relate to the character-driven elements of the plot?
So instead of, and I shouldn't say too much because hopefully people will see it and I shouldn't reveal too much of the plot, but I can say that the horror comes from within. It's not a film where there's blood and guts and running and screaming, you know, monsters and stuff like that. It's not about jump scares like most horror films are today. This is more about internal things. And the horror elements, it's tied up to Thelma, the main character's will. Like her deeper needs and her passions, and there's kind of an erotic side to this film as well. So it deals with some internal conflict, and I think that's what intrigued me to do a horror film about an internal struggle in the character rather than monsters and stuff.
And you've chosen not only to go down this completely different route compared to your previous film, but you've also returned to Norway. You only just made your first English language film. What drove that decision?
Actually, we started Thelma before we did Louder Than Bombs in New York. And there was a lot of discussions at the time, shouldn't you do this supernatural film in America because that's where it belongs? And I felt rather the opposite. I felt that putting it in the mysterious Norwegian woods and in Oslo that has this kind of side of the town that's never been used before, this brutalistic 70s architecture that you have quite a lot of in London as well, you know, to try to use those elements of Norway that we hadn't seen before and elevate them into this almost horror nightmarish thriller, I thought was more original and more fun. And as it turns out, it's you know, it's getting distributed now to, I don't know, we were up to 50 countries, I think, and still going. So it's possible to make Norwegian language films and have them travel. And this doesn't mean I won't be making films in English again. You know, that probably will happen. But I think it's about the setting being more original.
Joachim Trier, director of Thelma, out in cinemas this week. The film has been selected as Norway's entry in the Best Foreign Language Film category at next year's Academy Awards. Still to come, do you like scary movies? Our Halloween special continues with a look at why horror and comedy often make the perfect pair. And we'll explore a closet full of creepy creations as we take a special look at the fine art of costumes. But first, a word from the news desk. Director Guillermo del Toro has paid tribute to the great Argentinian actor Federico Lupi, who passed away at the age of 83. Lupi starred in three of del Toro's best-loved films, including Kronos, The Devil's Backbone, and Pan's Labyrinth. The Mexican filmmaker called Lupi one of the greatest Spanish-speaking actors, like the Laurence Olivier of Argentina. And the cameras are rolling on Barry Jenkins' new film, If Beale Street Could Talk, with news that actress Regina King has joined the cast. Jenkins spoke of the project during an interview on this very program, where he revealed that he actually started work on the script before he'd secured the rights. The film is an adaptation of the 1974 James Baldwin novel and tells the story of a woman in Harlem forced to prove her husband's innocence while pregnant with their child. This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned.
I am Dracula.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Hello, I'm Vincent Price. I'm here to introduce a new chilling series of classic ghost stories.
Being scared is, generally speaking, not a nice feeling, but in the hands of a master filmmaker and with the safe distance that cinema offers, fear somehow becomes an enjoyable and, at times, exhilarating experience. It's little wonder, then, that the lines between horror and camp comedy so often blur. Let's take a walk in the fog now with Daniel Clemens as he explores the creepy relationship between fun and frights.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, ghouls and ghosts. We are back to that time of the year, when witches cast their spells, when limbs of lovers are ripped off by psychotic killers, when the full moon brings werewolves out to play, and when darkness fills the land. Yes, it's October, and that means Halloween. For me, it all started as a young kid, sharing ghost stories with friends. I would scare myself to death at night, imagining dolls in my room coming to life and terrorizing me. I was frightened and could barely sleep some nights, but secretly, I loved the thrill. It led me to discover the world of horror, where I found a group of people who shared my same sense of humor and fondness for the dark and twisted. Yes, you heard me right. Some of the greatest comedy I've found has been while watching a horror film. Let's start with one of my favorites, Drag Me to Hell, a 2009 horror film directed by the horror master Sam Raimi, who also created the 80s classic Evil Dead. Drag Me to Hell tells the story of an up-and-coming bank loan officer, Christine, who's pining for a promotion. It's just another day at the bank for Christine when a gypsy woman calls in to ask about an extension on her loan. Christine refuses, and that turns out to be a big mistake. In one of my favorite scenes, the gypsy woman attacks Christine in a car park. False teeth fly, eyelids are stapled shut, and rulers become edible weapons. The gypsy woman thus curses Christine, giving her 7 days before she is dragged to hell.
You shame. Soon it will be you who comes begging to me.
This all sounds mad, but what I love about the film is it takes itself seriously while having its tongue planted firmly in its cheek. What Sam Raimi does so well is focus on the scares of the film, creating characters we can root for, but at the same time pushing the reality to 11, allowing it to be hilarious and terrifying all in the space of a few film frames. A popular genre of horror, which had a big blast in the 80s and a resurgence in recent years, is the horror comedy. Films such as Shaun of the Dead, Planet Terror, Zombievers, a film about killer zombie beavers, of course, and Reanimator, among others, focus on the laughs as well as the horror. The line between comedy and terror is often razor sharp and razor thin. Consider the absolute brutality and sheer terror of the 1974 seminal classic Texas Chainsaw Massacre. After seeing it on the big screen, I can still remember the sound of the chainsaw drilling into my ears. In its infamous dinner scene, the Sawyer family have trapped the last remaining girl and have forced her to eat dinner with them. In this late moment of the film, humor finds its way onto the screen when the old grandfather tries to hit the girl to death with a hammer, but being too weak, misses again and again. The repetition of the scene is both horrifying and hilarious, creating some sort of Laurel and Hardy sketch in the middle of all the terror.
Hit this bitch!
This scene once again so deftly crosses the line from horror to comedy and back again, while ripping apart all your senses. Then, of course, there are the camp classics. Often made with the very best dramatic intentions, their accidental absurdity carves out an eternal cult status. From Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, starring Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, and the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer, starring Christy Swanson, to 1985's Fright Night, and one of my favourites, the 80s slasher movie Sleepaway Camp.
Welcome to Sleepaway Camp. Someone is watching you.
Hey, Baba, Reba!
Someone is waiting for you. Someone wants to scare you to death.
Oh my God!
Sleepaway Camp. You won't be coming home.
This bizarre horror comedy was the work of first-time director Richard Hiltzik, arriving in theatres soon after 1980's Friday the 13th, which had made the teenage, summer, camp slasher subgenre fashionable. Like Fright Night, the film combines a strange gay subtext with a sensational twist ending, making it one of the most unexpected cult classics. Researchers have found that horror movies can be cathartic, allowing us to feel fear without ever venturing close to actual danger. But for me, I think horror comedies represent something closer to everyday life. They're about seeing their irreverence in often mundane realities. It's one of the few genres where just about anything can happen. Even if we know we should be running out the front door instead of being chased up the stairs, we'll keep watching, because we need to know how it all ends. And then, when it does, there's always the rewind button. For Monocle, I'm Daniel Clemens.
Thank you, Daniel. Up next, from Morticia Adams to The Creature from the Black Lagoon, we'll examine the art of scary costumes. Remember that television series Feud, starring Susan Sarandon as a venomous Bette Davis, opposite Jessica Lange as the fading Joan Crawford? Well, Crawford actually made another picture with that same director of Whatever Happened to Baby Jane that's not often seen today. Autumn Leaves was originally titled The Way We Are. The title was changed after the success of the popular song as performed by Nat King Cole. The film is, admittedly, a soap opera that stops just shy of the all-out craziness of Baby Jane, but in the hands of Joan Crawford, it somehow comes together as a nourishing example of Hollywood melodrama. It's one of the films playing on Mubi right now. Sample a month for free by heading over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle.
It's amazing. It's incredible. Could it possibly belong to a Pleistocene man?
The chances are much greater that that hand belonged to an amphibian, Mark. One that spent a great deal of time in the water.
Well, then how do you account for the structure of the fingers? Obviously for land use. What do you think, Dr. Matos?
We can be sure of one thing. Whatever it was very powerful.
Would the creature from the Black Lagoon have become such an enduring icon if he'd appeared as slimy and ugly as one might imagine a real swamp monster to be? It's a tremendous credit to the Gilman's designer, Millicent Patrick, that the famous creature was just scary enough to provoke intrigue and curiosity without too much disgust. Patrick brought a wealth of artistic experience to her work on the classic monster movie. She had previously worked on the Disney animations of the 1940s, and her father was one of the architects involved with building William Randolph Hearst's infamous San Simeon Mansion. But her work on Creature from the Black Lagoon ignited furious jealousy in the head of Universal's makeup department, Bud Westmore, who demanded that he be considered the sole creator of the creature. Eventually, Westmore's tantrum led to her being exiled from future work at Universal, though today, thankfully, Millicent Patrick is rightfully regarded as, well, to use the words of Universal's own publicity pitch, the beauty who created the beast. Laura Sindel is a costume designer who specializes in creation effects for motion pictures, and with Halloween just around the corner, Monocle's Helena Jarrett sat down with Laura to find out what makes the perfect scary costume.
I think it
suppose what you find scary, really. I think for me, I particularly love designs from like films with amazing creatures. Like, I quite like old school ones, like Creature from like the Black Lagoon, that kind of like, yeah, those old school ones are great, which have also been represented, that kind of creature now in Guillermo del Toro's recent film, Shape of Water, that's about to come out. Mm-hmm. There's an amazing creature design in that. And I love seeing how there's that new kind of design of creature that's really inspired from, yeah, the old school ones as well.
Yeah.
They'll kind of keep evolving.
Do you want to just talk me through what you've brought with you today?
Sure.
Costumes.
I brought along just some little examples of things I've done in the past. So, yeah, I've got these gauntlets that you can kind of hear rattling away next to me. And I thought these were quite a good little example, actually, of a quick thing that you could even make. These I made, my gosh, they must be quite old now. I think I was about 20 when I made these.
Oh, wow.
And they are made out of biscuit tins, would you believe it or not?
No. Which kind of biscuit tins?
Oh, I'm not sure. You know what? The inside of every biscuit tin is about is sort of a golden silver colour, so you can get away with almost any biscuit
Brilliant.
Tin. They're probably like an old sort of Christmas box of, like, you
they
know,
seem to have
roses.
Lasted really well, as well.
Yeah, they have, actually. So they're just sewn onto a pair of leather gloves. They move really nicely, and they're quite a good little accompaniment that I've had for various costumes and stuff to wear. They move quite nicely.
Brilliant.
They make a very satisfying sound.
Yeah, no, very nice.
But yeah, they're just pieces of cut-up biscuit tin, shaped and formed, and then stitched onto these gloves. Yeah,
oh,
they
brilliant.
Make very good creepy claws.
And did you have kind of an image of an idea of a kind of monster you wanted to make when you made them? Or
yeah,
was it just...
I think I had a costume. Gosh, I'm not going to remember what it was now. I've used them for so many things. I had them, I think, for a costume back then, sort of when I first made these that I wore them for. I think it was from a video game called Soul Calibur that I made these kind of for.
That actually reminds me of my favourite Halloween films, Wes Craven's Nightmare on Elm Street, of course. They remind me of the
Freddy
Krueger.
They are a bit Freddy Krueger.
But I particularly remember how unrealistic a lot of the stuff in that film was. You kind of remember these classic scenes of the massive tongue coming through the phone and him running down the street with these like crazy arms stretching out into the distance.
No.
I remember being absolutely terrified and still watching it now being really terrified,
yeah,
but at the same
the
time
atmosphere.
Having that duality of knowing that it's not 100% realistic.
Yeah, sure.
Do you think that that's important, you know, do you think costumes need to be utterly revolting or 100% realistic, or do we actually like the slight kitsch, dated element to it that a lot of the old movie monsters maybe had?
I think both have their own merits, really. I think the old kitsch ones, like you're saying, the Freddy Kruegers and things like, you know, Creature from the Black Lagoon, it looks ridiculous now, it just looks like a man wearing flippers. But at the same time, those movies still have such an atmosphere around them that creates, that makes it scary because of that whole tension that's built around them, that even though you know it's a man in a rubber suit, it still has that same effect to it. Whereas now, of course, there are some amazing costumes out there that you see that look completely real and you can buy into them. And I suppose that does add that extra sense of terror as well to an outfit when they look so real. But it is quite nice to have that kitsch element as well, I think. I think there is something about it. People do love to go back and watch their old school scary films. I love watching them. Yeah, they are good fun always.
It's
a bit more fun, I guess.
Yeah, and it's quite comforting to think, you know, it's not 100% realistic.
Yeah.
It's actually still quite terrifying. Back in the day, kind of costumes, monsters, they'd embody people and society's fears. Mm. It was kind of like Godzilla and like Frankenstein. But now we're kind of seeing a generation that are a lot more focused on quite interchangeable CGI monsters, I think would be fair to say. Do you think that makes it harder for us as an audience to be scared now that we've got all these kind of similar CGI created monsters?
I think when you have too much CG or a completely CGI character, you can lose that believability in it because you know it's just a computer generated image on a screen. There's nothing behind it really more than that. I tend to find personally that that doesn't really scare me as much, or it's or not as believable for me. Whereas if you have someone, or at least a model or a sculpt or a puppet or something that is real and there in that scene that actors can act against and react to, you get a much more believable performance in a sense than what you're watching. So I do think, yeah, that then sometimes if there's just too much CG, I just switch off to it. It's like, it's another explosion. Mm. It's another, you know, kind of catastrophe that's happened that you just get a bit bored to and you kind of blank out to all of them. But I think CG and practical effects work really well together. which a lot of films are doing nowadays, that you have a big practical element, but then visual effects will go in after and touch everything up and just like neaten it up a little bit. So right. It looks better on screen and just enhance it in ways that you can't do in real life. And that's when I think you really get the perfect balance of something on screen, of a costume or a creature or whatever it is, when both work together.
Let's go back to the other things that you've brought today. Let's have a look at this bloodstained dress, is it? Talk me through this one.
So this was based off of a video game called Bioshock, which is a very scary game. And so a character called Little Sisters, and they're very creepy, like little girl characters that run around in this sort of apocalyptic underwater world. So I made this costume for that ages ago that I wore for Halloween a few years back. And so this was quite a good example I sort of found of actually weathering costumes and breaking them up so that they look a bit more sort of authentic, which is perfect for Halloween actually. So it's doing all the kind of classic things like a bit of a blood splatter on it, getting the old cheese grater out and breaking the fabric down and seams so it looks all rough. So you see at the bottom of the dress, it's all got this worn hem.
Frayed, yeah.
Just need a cheese grater.
Now we know.
And run it all along there, and then you're good to go.
Halloween sorted.
Yeah. So then you can just make your costume look a bit more rough and worn in and creepy. And then I think I also dyed this with quite a lot of like tea and coffee. They're perfect for stuff like that.
That's like yellowing stains.
Yeah.
As well.
Do you remember when you were at school and you had to like yellow paper and stuff, and you burnt the edges to make it look like it was all old like a map?
But obviously, as well as CGI, going back to that, there's now the focus on, you know, fixing it in post-production. Do you think that is a threat at all to the costume and prop industry, or do you think it just kind of works alongside it?
A bit of both. I mean, sometimes it can threaten it. There are instances, you know, where suddenly, like, something practical can just be completely cut because they just want to fix it in post afterwards. That often happens, and, you know, it can be for numerous reasons that can happen, really. But then at the same time, it's a great way of being able to enhance something as well, like I mentioned earlier, that you can actually think, oh, well, we can mostly create this and then just add a little bit on top afterwards. Like if it's something that has like a ridiculous element attached to it that wouldn't be possible to do in real life, they still think that, oh, well, we can get the majority of it, you know, for real in camera and then just add a little bit on top. It doesn't necessarily take away work from costume or like creatures and props. You know, they're two things that just work kind of independently, but also coincide with one another at the same time, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And people are always going to need costume and design, aren't they? I mean,
yeah, they'll always need to be costumes in there. That'd be hard to CG on someone.
Helena Jarrett there with costume designer Laura Sindel. That's all for this week's program. Next week, it's our very special 100th episode. We'll count down our very own curated list of 100 great movies, featuring Xavier Dolan, Kelly Reichardt, and Barry Jenkins. That's next week's special program. You don't want to miss it. Today's show was edited and mixed by Christy Evans and researched by Yolene Goffin. This has been The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. Happy Halloween.
The falling leaves drift by the window. The autumn leaves of red and gold. I see your lips, the summer kisses, the sunburned hands I used to